This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at the impact that prolonged inflation has in the banking sector.
Plus, home improvement retailers have opportunity to grow in an underpenetrated e-commerce market.
But first, let's go COVID, let's go vaccines, let's go boosters. You can get boosters now here in the U.S. There are some age restrictions, but it feels like this is definitely the path of least resistance when it comes to the vaccine. So now what? Sam Fazeli, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Pharmaceutical Analyst, joins us now. Is this going to be an annual COVID booster thing, Sam?
Alex, that's an excellent question. And I think that we're probably going to need some more data before we get to that point. But I think generally, given what we know about these kind of viral infections, coronaviruses previously, it's possible that we're going to need that that extra cover once a year just to make sure that we don't even get what people call a mild infection, which, as you know, I'm going through right now, and it's not fun.
It's not fun, and the good news is you're coming out to the other side, which is great. Sam, talk to us about kind of the efficacy of these booster shots. I mean, it's hard enough to get people to get two shots. You know, I'm concerned that, you know, the third one might push people over the edge here. But talk to us about the value of this booster shot.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, a lot of people keep having their annual flu shots without asking any question, and that's not even that effective, relatively speaking. Here we have a vaccine that, at least in the phase 3 trials and what we're seeing out of Israel, gives you about a 95% efficacy, or over 90% efficacy against an infection, and that's compared to people who had two doses. So, you know, we're seeing that's pretty phenomenal. So, and I think people, when they hear those numbers, are going to want to have this shot. And the side effect profile is milder, if not at worst, the same as what you had after the dose two. So I think people are going to want this.
Sam, is there going to be some point where they might just package up, it, for lack of a better word, the flu shot with the COVID shot, so you kind of go in once in, you know, the fall like we do now?
Well, yeah, at least one company is trying to do that, and that's Moderna. They are developing a co-formulated shot. I mean, the only difference it makes, Paul, as to what you've got to be able to do now is instead of two jabs at the same visit, you get one jab. I mean, you know, frankly, either way, I'll be happy with getting my protection against the two infectious diseases to get me ready for the winter.
Mm-hmm. No, fair enough. Hey, Sam, you also came down with COVID after being vaccinated with AstraZeneca, and I just wanted to know, like, what did you learn?
I learned that you can get something that resembles a really, really bad cold.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't the sniffles, so anyone who ever calls it the sniffles again, you have to obviously judge it by my age. I'm 57 years old, so I'm not necessarily in the prime of my life.
Oh, but, you're in the prime, Sam. Who are you talking about?
Yeah, well, yeah, okay, prime of this life anyway.
Okay. Sam, talk to us about therapeutics, assuming that this is something that, you know, we hear from the experts like yourself that it's not going away. We're going to be dealing with this for years to some level. So therapeutics become, you know, arguably as, you know, equally as important here. Where are we?
Yeah, so we have one drug that's in the process of going through regulatory review, et cetera, and that's the Merck drug, molnupiravir. Merck and Ridgeback, who co-developed it. But I have to say, I've been thinking about this a bit, Paul. Would I have taken the drug? I think currently the data suggests that it's for people who have risk and prevention for hospitalization. The other trial that Roche did with a very similar molecule, trying to treat mild to moderate COVID, made no difference, which is me, right? So that's where I'm not sure where that drug will land in terms of what it does for us. And of course, now we have more data coming from Pfizer with a drug with a different mechanism, hopefully before the end of the year. And everyone's keeping fingers crossed on that one, too. Let's hope that's positive, because it gives us yet another shot at this nasty virus.
I'm going to harken back to the beginning of a lot of this when we talked about vaccinations and how there was a lot of shortages of the vials and shipping were issues and all of that stuff. All I hear about from companies are the supply chain issues. And I'm wondering, as we're ramping up boosters here in developed markets, we got vaccine for kids now coming on, and we're still trying to get this stuff out to the developing world. How hard is it? Is it easier than we think? Is it harder than we're making it out to be?
Well, manufacturing. Pfizer had their third quarter results today. 4 billion doses to be made next year.
Wow.
They've already got contracts for 1.7 billion. 1 billion of that is going to the U.S. to go to low-income countries. So there's another 2.3 billion doses up for grabs. And you know what the CEO says? He says, I'm not getting calls. I'm not getting people coming from the low-income countries looking for doses. We're here. We're going to give it at cost. Why not? COVAX is not going to them. Is it because they think that it's got a tough logistics angle, which brings us to the next point, in terms of them needing a frozen supply chain, if you like? Well, the full dose, the 30 micrograms that Pfizer-BioNTech sell, can be kept in the refrigerator for a month. So I don't understand why a central system can't be developed where you get the frozen stuff and then dish it out to where it can be refrigerated for a month.
Sam, we really appreciate it. Sam Vazzelli, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Pharmaceutical Analyst.
Coming up on the program, Robinhood faces risk from shifting retail demand. More on that to come.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's talk retail trading here. You think about that. You think about some of the zero fees trading platforms that are out there. It seems like they're everywhere. And we've seen it over the pandemic. You know, think about the meme stock trading frenzy that was at the beginning of the pandemic. It's still there. It's still a thing. And Robinhood took full advantage of that. Let's bring in Julie Chariello. She covers a senior fintech and payments analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Just give us a sense of where Robinhood is right now relative to their competition. How big are they, and what's the competitive landscape, and how are they doing?
So when it comes to mobile online only,
yeah, that's
brokerage,
right,
they're the leader. You know, 20 million users, more than that if you look at just overall accounts that they've had, right? So active users is quite a large number. It's down a little bit from where it was at the start of the year when it really peaked with that meme stock frenzy. But it's still holding up pretty well. In the second quarter, they got into crypto, and that was really big for them. It was big because they were making Dogecoin available, and that was the hot coin of 2Q. In 3Q, the hot coin was Shiba Inu coin. They didn't offer that. They felt the pain. So that's really where they are, is lots of users, but very much at the whim of the market and what those retail users want to buy, what they want to do today.
Are retail guys as active as they were, I don't know, 8 months ago?
Yeah, good question. They are not.
How do we know that?
So there are some ways that we can estimate that based on overall trading volume and where it's flowing, right? So we have some folks at Bloomberg Intelligence, Larry Tabb, who looks at the markets, and he's an expert there. And they look through the exchanges where the activity is happening and come up with an estimate of retail trading. It was running at a high 20-21% of overall volume at the start of the year. Now it's back down to around 19%. Still elevated, but coming downward when you look at the percentage of volume.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, the issue was the beginning of the pandemic, oh, we can't go out, maybe we can't gamble, maybe we can't, you know, go and play some sports bets or things like that. What's the next best thing? Let's day trade. Has that game kind of played out? Has that faded as, you know, we were starting to open up again?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing some signs of that. So people just don't have as much time to sit around, right, and watch stocks and transact in stocks, right? So there is just less volume flowing through from that. We saw the bulk of that in the second quarter. So equity trading volume overall in the second quarter for Robinhood was down about 60%. It
Wow.
really fell off from first quarter to second quarter. Didn't slow down as much in the third quarter. It was down about 11, not even less than 10%. So we saw the effects of that primarily. I think that is kind of shaken out now, right? We're kind of back at more normal mm-hmm. levels. But now it's about what gets those retail customers going again. Is there going to be another meme stock kind of bubble created? Or is going to continue to be crypto mm-hmm. now that crypto seems to be the area of activity?
This week, I feel like it was Avis.
Yes.
So like it's there. Yes. They're definitely still there in some respects. So is Robinhood going to have to get more creative in what they're offering? I mean, because it's going to be hard to make it more of a gaming site, right? Because then the SEC is going to be mad at them and crack down.
Yes.
But they need to kind of sex it up a little to get people to come back or more frequently or get different kind of products to get different people in.
That's exactly what they're focused on doing now. And they're realizing that, okay, we have this core base of clients. We've pretty much been able to hold on to them despite some of the ups and downs and some of the concerns about trading being halted during the meme frenzy and so on. They've been mostly able to hold on to them. But how are they going to keep them growing? How are they going to be able to make money when trading volumes are down? And so they are looking at new products. Crypto is one. A very important one that's coming in the first quarter are crypto wallets. So they allow people to hold their own crypto, do what they want with it. If they want to buy Shiba Inu coin somewhere else, they can still mm-hmm. have that wallet and still work with Robinhood. So that's a new area. Wealth management is probably the next thing that they'll go after. So offering people tax advantage retirement accounts. So definitely beginning to diversify, looking really kind of more like a Charles Schwab, mm. right? Or a TD Ameritrade over time in order to get away from that reliance on volume only.
So they reported some numbers recently, and as I recall, not very well received. Just give us a summary there.
Yeah, the third quarter was really tough. Overall, stock trading volume wasn't down that much, as I said. Options volume was pretty flat. It was all about crypto. So it was about 2Q numbers being huge. They really burst on the scene with retail investors opening up crypto accounts in Robinhood, up 166% in the second quarter. And the majority of that was so that those customers could trade Dogecoin. Their closest competitor in crypto is Coinbase. Coinbase mm. wasn't offering Dogecoin. Comes to the third quarter, the cryptocurrency of the time was Shiba Inu coin. Robinhood doesn't offer Shiba Inu coin, at least as of the third quarter. Coinbase does offer it. Okay. And so they saw a 66% decline mm. in their crypto volume. And these are the kinds of waves that they've had to deal with now until they're able to round out their product portfolio, offer more kinds of things to smooth out their revenue stream.
Do you think that Robinhood is going to be able to keep making money from payment for order flow and the same amount they're used to?
I think the concerns about payment for order flow in terms of regulation have definitely begun to subside.
Oh,
there have been
okay.
some studies done. The SEC came out with one a few weeks ago. Didn't get that much play. But what it did show is that retail investors through those payment for order flow arrangements got pretty good pricing. And so some of the pressure seems to be off now. There also isn't a great fix, right? And the fix is likely going to result in retail investors paying commissions, right? Which is not really what the SEC wants, right? They want to be on the side of the retail investor. So I think the pressure is off for now. This system seems to be working, and I think it'll keep moving along.
You know, I'm a little nervous about stock stories, companies that really have to really modify their business, really pivot, because, you know, I bought the IPO, this management team, this business model, and this one, theirs was just selling order flow. Now they got to pivot to become more like, you said, a Charles Schwab, you know, wealth management services, banking services. Do you think they can do it?
I think they have the customer base that gives them the footing to put out a product and have a good number of people hop on board, right? And if that's the case, they should be able to manage through that investment, mm-hmm. right? The investment they have to make to come up with that product. If they have this captive audience of users that are going to adopt it, it's a perfectly good business model. The question is, how do they continue to stay out ahead of the competition, right? Because there are increasing number of providers out there who offer mobile apps.
All right, Julie, thank you so much. We appreciate it. As always, that's Julie Chariel, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior FinTech and Payments Analyst.
All right, coming up on the program, the prolonged inflationary environment that we're seeing is lifting yields and lifting forecasts for bank revenue.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts, covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Now let's take a look at what's happening with banks and the yield curve and just straight up higher yields, particularly in the short end. So we've seen a big re-rating in the bond market pretty much all across the board, particularly in the UK, the US, Australia, and a little bit over in Europe as well. So what does that actually mean for banks? Want to bring in Jonathan Tice, a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior EU Banks Analyst. So the yield curve is where a lot of banks can live and die in terms of how they're going to make their money off of loans. So I guess the first question to ask real quick is, how's demand? How's loan demand?
Well, loan demand is, apart from mortgages, been pretty poor, actually, because if you think about the last 18 to 24 months, governments globally have been underwriting preferential corporate loan rates for small businesses and big businesses. People have been staying at home, so they've been paying down credit card balances, so another very high margin product for the banks. They haven't been making any money there. And obviously, everybody cut rates 18, 20 months ago as the pandemic really hit home. So rates destroyed interest income for banks, and loan demand went away. And to be honest, we haven't seen much of it coming back. So mortgages have been, certainly in the UK and Europe, and to an extent in the US, pretty much the only game in town.
And John, as you think about your coverage, what area is going to be, do you think, is going to be in the rising rate environment initially? Will it be the UK or the EU?
Definitely UK. I mean, I think the UK pretty much is going to be a world leader in kicking off the rate rises. Europe will be very much deferred, because clearly when you've got 27 countries, all of those different concerns to address, it's not straightforward. So, I mean, will it be this week or will it be in December? I think almost certainly we're going to get a small rate increase this year.
So let's talk about net interest income then. What did we learn from UK banks for the third quarter, and what's their outlook for the next quarter?
Well, the good thing is, I mean, I haven't heard HSBC management ever really be kind of upbeat. They were talking in an upbeat way, which is okay. Unusual. Lloyds Bank, Barclays, two of the really big banks over here with about 50% credit card market share, they were talking an upbeat game. They all give us these sensitivities, but it's a very touchy-feely sort of sensitivity, because clearly it depends what the shape of the curve is. Is it the short end rising? Is it the long end rising? Where are you positioned on the curve? But bear in mind, another fallout from the pandemic is excess liquidity. All banks are swimming in liquidity. So normally when rates rise, yes, they can charge more for loans. Yes, they can get more from the government assets that they invest in. But they also have to pass on some of that rate increase to deposit holders. At the moment, because everybody's awash with liquidity, they don't need to do that. So actually, any incremental revenue, you don't give some of it back on the funding side. So that they were all pretty upbeat. They were talking about lower pass-through rates than normal. So yes, it's relatively looking pretty good compared to the horror show that has been the revenue story for the last few years.
It seems longer than that, actually. Talk to us about the stocks, Jonathan. How have they performed? Is there room to grow? What are you hearing from your clients?
Well, I mean, banks, a lot of people have been underweight banks for a long time for the right reasons. And yes, inflation and yes, rising rates is a positive. Don't forget, though, that when rates rise, you also have wage inflation. And the one thing, because banks didn't have revenue growth, they were focusing on was cost growth. So if you look at the likes of Standard Charter today, the bank gets hit very, very hard, albeit on numbers that optically were in line, because people are now concerned that what has to happen on the cost side, the inflation, completely destroy all of the benefits of rising revenue. So I think the market's more evenly positioned in banks now. There was a big underweight. I suspect that underweight is by and large shut. So you really have to believe that it's more of a one-way asymmetric positive with inflation and rising rates, and not that this time next year growth will slow down, bad debts begin to rise, wage inflation's coming through. We don't think that. But that said, I mean, you look at the valuations as well. They're not cheap. They're not expensive, so investors and clients we're talking to, it's more about stock selection and where do you get the best bang for your buck relative now.
But John, aren't we already seeing wage inflation? I mean, I keep hearing about how much these banks are competing against each other for talent, particularly even more so for the UK, because a lot of the bankers are moving to European locations and banks now.
Well, that matters for Barclays, but less so for most banks that don't have the same degree of investment banking and corporate investment banking exposure. It also matters for banks with big emerging markets exposure, because that's where you feel wage inflation fastest. So for a lot of the continental Europeans, for a Lloyds and for a NatWest, actually, we're a lot less worried about the cost growth. For someone like a Barclays, yeah, absolutely. I mean, how much do they need to keep paying up?
All right, Jonathan, thanks a lot. Jonathan Tice, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior EU Banks Analyst.
Coming up on the program, opportunity for home improvement e-commerce. Plus, grocers and fast food sellers are positioned to benefit from the demise of the penny.
The penny. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
As Paul just told me, if you want to go buy a piece of plywood, you're going into a Home Depot and a Lowe's. You're not going to buy that online. And as a result, some of these home center guys have underpenetrated in the e-commerce space. But our next guest says that maybe that could change. I want to bring in Drew Redding, Bloomberg Intelligence Home Builders Analyst. Drew, am I going to order plywood from online here?
Typically not. I mean, so just to take a step back, online sales in the home improvement retail space are about $14 billion of $250 billion roughly in measured retail sales. So that's only about 6% penetration compared to the broader retail space at 13%. So some of the things that come to mind naturally are the nature of the product set, like you mentioned. When you think about things like lumber, millwork, cabinetry, flooring, windows, appliances, these are bulky items. They require more specialized distribution systems, but also they're bigger ticket items that shoppers typically want to see in person. And, you know, a lot of times you're working through the purchase process with a store employee who has expertise on the subject matter. So I think that's the primary factor at play here when you talk about home improvement retail, is just the nature of the product set. But I also think it has to do with the customer, because when you talk about the bigger stores like a Home Depot and Lowe's, they're generating about 40% and 25% of sales, respectively, from contractors. Now, a lot of times, you know, they're making unscheduled stops into the store or, you know, in the morning on the way to a job site because they need something on demand. And, you know, you can pretty much get anything through one-day shipping now from just about anyone. But I do think that there's an added level of convenience within this industry in particular.
So you mentioned the transportation of these things. How do you solve for that if I want to order a tub online? Is Amazon going to box that up for me?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why when you talk about, you know, the threat from Amazon versus home improvement retail, I think there's somewhat of a moat around them.
Right.
And it's because Home Depot and Lowe's have made such significant investments in their supply chain, their distribution centers. So they're able to ship all that stuff out of warehouses. They have, you know, the fleet of flatbeds where they could easily load that stuff and get that to customers in you know, a day or two when it's available. And I just think at this point, that's not really something that Amazon is perhaps set up to do. Now, they certainly do compete, you know, with the smaller products. So when we talk about online penetration in home improvement retail, it's very product specific. So, you know, some of the categories that you do see purchased online are less bulky, more commodity type products like lawn and garden, electrical and lighting and hardware. But even that being said, no category is really more than 40%. So in-store is still kind of the desired method of purchase.
So isn't that good for those companies in that it would cost them so much to ship a tub or to ship the plywood that they can't sort of compete on that level? So isn't it a good thing that they're going to have this, like, in some ways, dedicated store foot traffic that's like can't really migrate online?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely a competitive advantage for the bigger players. Like I said, I don't think that at this point Amazon has the distribution capabilities to handle those type of products. But where they do compete, and actually, you know, we looked at a recent survey that said, where have consumers made their most recent home improvement product purchases? And Amazon was actually number one, but it was not very far ahead of Home Depot or Lowe's.
Drew, give us a sense of kind of where we are now versus, you know, kind of the beginning of the pandemic when people were just rushing to the Lowe's and Home Depot's as they were working on their homes. Give us a sense of how the business has evolved.
So from an online perspective, I think that these guys definitely pulled forward, you know, a couple years of online sales. But when you think about how, you know, consumer shopping habits have evolved and how sticky they've become, you know, maybe consumers aren't going out and shopping online because they're worried about health concerns, but they've experienced the convenience in doing so, and that's become more of a habit now. The home centers have undergone a period of very heavy investment, particularly Lowe's, which has kind of lagged behind. You know, they've made investments in merchandising, so they're expanding the number of products they offer online. Fulfillment, so delivery is faster and more efficient for the consumer. But something else that I think is interesting is that somewhere around 60% of online orders from Home Depot and Lowe's are actually picked up in the store.
It's called omni-channel.
Yeah.
To the insiders.
Yeah, exactly. I do like doing that.
Yeah.
Also because I can be focused, not get distracted. I have to say that I bought a dishwasher from Wayfair,
yeah,
canceled the order, refunded my money, and then they sent it to me anyway.
Nice.
And I didn't realize it until it was already installed. And I was like, well, that's not a very good business model, Wayfair. All right, Drew, thanks a lot. Really appreciate Drew Redding, Bloomberg Intelligence home builders analyst.
Do you carry change around?
I don't carry anything. Like my daughter will be like, do you have a quarter? I'll be like, I have no money. I have my phone.
You're one of those. Okay, I got it. Okay, I've never been a big change person, so I just throw it in the corner. Well, I got all those coins up this weekend, took them to the supermarket where they got one of those machines.
Yeah.
$90.
Ooh,
how about that?
Cha-ching.
So, yeah, so let's talk about coins, particularly the penny. There's always talk about getting rid of the penny. I mean, who really needs the penny? Let's talk to Andrew Silverman, Bloomberg Intelligence Government and Tax Policy Analyst. Andrew, what's going on with the penny? Are we going to finally phase this thing out?
So, yeah, I think it's possible that the penny may have met the end of its life. And I say that because Congress tends to focus on savings devices like getting rid of the penny when there's a reason to focus on currency. And right now, the director of the Mint has just left. We have an acting director. The president has to pick a new director of the Mint within, you know, 180 days. So,
ooh, I think I'd be interested in that. Be around money all day? I could do that.
Pennies.
Yeah,
but okay.
True. Yeah. It adds up.
But the other thing is that the government is looking for revenue, right? They've got the Build Back Better bill. And they've come up with all of these different ideas to come up with revenue to pay for it, but it's a lot of money. And the new ideas they've replaced with the older ideas, which are very traditional, and we know exactly how much revenue we're going to raise from raising the corporate income tax, from raising individual tax rates. But we don't really know how much money we're going to raise from a 15% minimum tax, from a stock buyback tax. And we know pretty much how much we can raise from getting rid of the penny. So
how much can we raise again?
It's about $133 million a year, which is not a whole lot, right? When you're talking about $400 billion for tax audits, but it's something.
Okay.
And I think in the scrum of things, when they're coming up with revenue to fill gaps, when the you know, Congressional Budget Office comes up with an estimate that they're short, you know, so much revenue, getting rid of the penny might come to mind, and they say, "Oh, well, we'll just stick it in," and that's the end of that, right? Something inconceivable can happen overnight.
So, okay, so say they take all the pennies, retire them, pay for some stuff. Like, is there an investable angle to this? Are there, like, winners and losers in the stock market if we ditch the penny?
So I think there are. And the reason I say that is because Canada got rid of the penny not so long ago. And there have been some studies on what happened when their penny went away. Some retailers, especially gas stations, grocery stores, places like that, raised their prices because you can no longer charge in cents anymore. You have to charge in nickels and dimes. And by the way, most prices end in a nine. And so what are you going to do? You have to round up. And even retailers that round down tend to round up later on. So they get the credit for, you know, rounding down. And then later on they say, well, you know, and then they have to raise their prices 5 or 10 cents at a time. And so prices go up faster.
I think about that. Like the grocery store in particular, it always seems to be $99. So the grocers, I guess, would be a big one.
Exactly. That's right.
Unless you went to like 95 cents. But then to your point, if you had a price increase, you go straight up to the dollar.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How about the dollar stores? What do you do with the
dollar? Ooh, yeah, good call. Yeah, I mean, the dollar store doesn't only sell stuff that's a dollar. Like, they have other stuff. But so some fast food, grocery stores. What about stuff like Dollar Tree, Dollar Store? That's
yeah, exactly. Those two. I mean, they're going to have to raise their prices as well. And the people that go to those stores are more likely to spend their money using currency, because the people that tend to do that are underbanked or unbanked. They don't have bank accounts. They don't have credit cards. They have to use cash. And so they're the ones that are going to use pennies, and they're the ones that will have to pay in nickels and dimes. And by the way, a lot of countries, when they get rid of the penny, they end up producing more nickels and dimes and quarters. What does that mean? Well, nickels, dimes, and quarters are made out of copper and nickel. The penny is the only coin made out of zinc. And so you have a zinc producer in Tennessee. The only zinc producer that supplies the U.S. Mint is located in Tennessee. If you get rid of the zinc contract, that's, you know, $126 million at the cost of goods sold for producing a penny. But then you have the only nickel producer in the United States, Lundin Mining in Michigan. They would get more orders for nickels, dimes, and quarters. So, you know, winners and losers.
Other than the zinc producer in Tennessee, is anybody else against this?
So there are a lot of people on the Hill who seem to be extremely opposed to the penny. The last time they had a hearing on the penny, well, it wasn't really on the penny, but they spent most of the time talking about the penny, was when David Ryder was made the head of the Mint. And he got peppered with questions about the penny. And some of the legislators were saying things like, you know, the penny to me is just litter. When I see it on the ground, I just kick it into the street. I never pick it up. And David Ryder said, well, I always pick up pennies. But of course, he's the Mint director, you know.
Right.
And apparently there's a penny contingent, pro-penny. In Congress. And most of those folks are from Illinois. Why? Because Lincoln's on the penny. So they don't want to get rid of it.
It gets political.
And
gets
Senator political. Durbin is essentially the head of that contingent. He's in the Senate. He's the second most powerful senator in the Senate amongst Democrats. So, you know, how are you going to get rid of the penny when Durbin's in power?
There's nothing I don't love about this conversation. Yep. And I feel like it's an SNL skit waiting to happen. Andrew, thanks a lot. Andrew Silverman, Bloomberg Intelligence government and tax policy analyst.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.